Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to Vatican Weekend. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, as always at this time of week, Jill Bevilacqua brings us the next in her series, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. I'd like to present part 5 of the series, The Task of Happiness, of Human Suffering and Christian Joy, presented by Dominican preacher and poet, Father Paul Murray. But first, as we begin the month of January, I'd like to wish you all a very happy and peaceful New Year. And because I haven't had a chance to do this already, I'd like to step back in time for a moment and bring you a report on the message of Pope Francis for the World Day of Peace, which falls on January the 1st each year. Anne Schneibel has the story.
In the message signed December 8, 2015, the Pope acknowledged the various forms of war, terrorism, and persecution present in today's world, but said there is reason to hope. He cited several events over the course of the year 2015, including the various initiatives confronting climate change, the 50th anniversary of Vatican II, and the Jubilee of Mercy. Referencing the theme of the message, the Holy Father then highlighted various forms of indifference in society. First, there is indifference to God, which in turn leads to indifference to one's neighbor and subsequently to the environment. Pope Francis also addressed what he referred to as an indifference to mercy, as seen in the Genesis account of Cain murdering his brother Abel. God intervenes, the message reads. He sees, hears, comes down, and delivers. God does not remain indifferent. He is attentive and he acts. Mercy is the heart of God, the Pope writes, and therefore must be the heart of all his children. Pope Francis said we are called to compassion, love, mercy, and solidarity in our relationships with one another. He added that the conversion of our hearts is needed for us to become open to others in authentic solidarity. The Pope also called for the building of a culture of solidarity and mercy in order to overcome indifference. This task begins with families, he said, which are the first place where the values of love, fraternity, togetherness, and sharing, concern and care for others are lived out and handed on. He spoke also of the role of teachers and communicators. Pope Francis went on to say that peace is the fruit of a culture of solidarity, mercy, and compassion. It is also a sign of the Jubilee of Mercy, which began December 8th, in which all are called to recognize indifference and improve the world around us. The Pope concluded by entrusting the reflection contained in the message to the Blessed Virgin Mary.
You were listening there to Anne Schneibel. Our thanks go to her. And now, as promised, time to join Jill Bevilacqua for the next in her series, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, as she brings us a selection of readings and reflections for this Sunday's Gospel. Stay tuned.
In the beginning was the Word. The Word was in God's presence, and the Word was God. He was present to God in the beginning. Through him all things came into being, and apart from him nothing came to be. Whatever came to be in him found life, life for the light of men. The light shines on in darkness, a darkness that did not overcome it. The real light, which gives light to every person, was coming into the world. He was in the world, and through him the world was made. Yet the world did not know who he was. To his own he came, yet his own did not accept him. Any who did accept him, he empowered to become children of God. These are they who believe in his name, who were begotten not by blood, nor by carnal desire, nor by man's willing it, but by God. The Word became flesh, and made his dwelling among us, and we have seen his glory, the glory of an only Son, coming from the Father, filled with enduring love.
Well, Although the Gospel of John is not a story in the way we usually think of one, and although today's scholars tell us that the prologue seems to be based on an early hymn and may have been added after the Gospel was completed, the very first words call up immediately the image of the storyteller and his listeners gathered around him, listeners who may have heard the story many, many times, but who, like children waiting for the special moment of the bedtime story, ask their mother to read or to tell a favourite one, heard countless times, but which somehow never tires, never fails to enchant, to absorb, to entrance. Once upon a time. But ours is no fairy story, and though we've heard it times without number, it's always new. For as we go through life, its many facets are revealed to us according to the moment in time our world is living through and our own individual moment of life. And I like to think of John, the beloved disciple, not so much as John the Divine, or the Theologian, or John, Bishop of Ephesus, or even John the Evangelist, but as John the Survivor, left behind as Jesus had foretold, waiting in Ephesus for his master's call, waiting perhaps on the seashore. And around him are his disciples, eagerly awaiting the moment when he will open the book of his mind and begin, as he always does, at the beginning of the good news. John is an old man now, no longer one of the impulsive Sons of Thunder, the nickname Jesus had given to him and his brother James, no longer ambitious for a seat on the right hand of the Lord in his glory, but content to wait till the Lord comes. But his disciples are anxious. It will not be long, they think, and he should put down in writing what only he can pass on to the future generations. Someone will take it down, for John surely was illiterate, a simple fisherman. And could he have seen well enough to write, even if he were able to? Surely his sight must have been poor at such an age. John the eagle-eyed. Who but he, when Jesus appeared for the last time on the shores of the lake that morning long ago, had known him at once and whispered to Peter, "It is the Lord." Now, on the shores of the Aegean, far from home, the former fisherman gazes out to sea and repeats once again the message of hope for all mankind.
In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God, and the Word was God.
The Word became flesh in today's version, was made flesh in others. The word flesh in the Semitic mentality, we're told, means the condition of mankind in its weakness and fragility. And made his dwelling among us, or he lived among us, dwelt among us in the old familiar version. And this too has a Jewish origin, referring to the tent in which Yahweh made himself present to the people of Israel on their journey through the desert. And this image of the tent we find again in this extract from Ecclesiasticus. Once more, wisdom is speaking.
I had my tent in the heights, and my throne in a pillar of cloud. Alone I encircled the vault of the sky, and I walked on the bottom of the deeps, over the waves of the sea and over the whole earth, and over every people and nation I have held sway. Among all these I searched for rest, and looked to see in whose territory I might pitch camp. Then the Creator of all things instructed me, and he who created me fixed a place for my tent. He said, "Pitch your tent in Jacob, make Israel your inheritance." From eternity in the beginning, he created me, and for eternity I shall remain. I ministered before him in the holy tabernacle, and thus was I established on Zion. In the beloved city he has given me rest, and in Jerusalem I wield my authority. I have taken root in a privileged people, in the Lord's property, in his inheritance.
And our scholar writes,
There are several elements common to both wisdom personified and the Logos word of the prologue. Both exist from the beginning and take part in the creative work of God. Both are with God and come down among men. Nevertheless, while wisdom is created, the Logos word is himself God. The Logos, the eternal and infinite word, enters the human dimension of space and time, of life and death.
And so, as yet another of our scholars writes,
St. John begins his gospel by introducing the Son of God, whom he calls the Logos, or active and revealing word of the Father, that is, the second person of the Holy Trinity, who is God, as the Father is, and works with him in the creation of the world.
And before we go on, here's an unexpected declaration, or rather, it's the person who makes it who is unexpected. In a life of Queen Elizabeth I, published in 1675, the author quotes her answer on being asked her opinion of Christ's presence in the sacrament. This is what Elizabeth said. "'Twas God the Word that spake it. He took the bread and brake it. And what the Word did make it, that I believe and take it." And now to another of the basic themes of this prologue, that of light. Light as opposed to darkness, which in biblical language was the symbol of death, of sin, and the power of evil. Opposed to this is light, symbol of life and salvation. Darkness in John's Gospel signifies a refusal of God and a mind closed to revelation and the salvation offered by Jesus, as also the condition of mankind and of the world so far from God. The Word, Logos in the original Greek, and for John, Christ. The Stoic philosophers used the word Logos to indicate the creative and ordering principle of the universe. But, writes a scholar, the term has its roots in the Old Testament, which celebrated the divine creative word, the wisdom of the Lord, who orders everything in harmony of being. Christ, therefore, is at the origins of reality and of life, and is in the fullness of divinity. This first moment is followed by another, which represents the history of salvation. A present-day dictionary defines the word as the divine wisdom manifest in the creation, government, and redemption of the world, and identified in Christian thought with the second person of the Trinity, Jesus Christ. John, writes our scholar, develops themes which are already present in the wisdom books of the Old Testament. In Proverbs, we read,
"From everlasting I was firmly set, from the beginning, before earth came into being. When he fixed the heavens firm, I was there. When he laid down the foundations of the earth, I was by his side, a master craftsman, delighting him day after day, ever at play in his presence, at play everywhere in his world, delighting to be with the sons of men."
The central theme of John's Gospel, the scholars tell us, is that of the Incarnation, also central to the whole of the New Testament. But in John's case, it's particularly marked. In reaction probably to the emergence of the Gnostic doctrines, which denied the divine word made flesh. A man who felt this deeply was the 17th century metaphysical poet and mystic Henry Vaughan, who wrote in The World,
"I saw eternity the other night, like a great ring of pure and endless light, all calm as it was bright, and round beneath it, time, in hours, days, years, driven by the spheres, like a vast shadow moved, in which the world and all her train were hurled. Yet some, who all this while did weep and sing and weep, soared up into the ring, but most would use no wing. O fools, said I, thus to prefer dark night before true light, to live in grots and caves, and hate the day because it shows the way which from this dead and dark abode leads up to God, a way where you might tread the sun and be more bright than he. But as I did their madness so discuss, one whispered thus, "This ring the bridegroom did for none provide, but for his bride."
A more hopeful note is sounded in this hymn attributed to the 4th century bishop and doctor of the church, St. Hilary of Poitiers, champion of orthodoxy against Arianism.
O resplendent giver of light, like lightning at your command, the time of darkness is past, and daylight, re-given, spreads abroad. You are the true giver of light to the world, not as the tiny star, which, harbinger of the sun's rising, burns only with a feeble flame, but brighter than the fullest sun, all light and day, you light up the deepest sentiments of our hearts. Assist us, O creator of the world, mirror of the light of the Father, for our flesh is fearful of losing your grace.
And now for a poem, Out in the Dark, by Edward Thomas, inspired, he said, by his small daughter. Perhaps she was afraid of the dark. But something in these lines suggests the poet's yearning for a faith, for a light he never had.
Out of the dark, over the snow, the fallow fawns invisible go with the fallow doe, and the winds blow, fast as the stars are slow. Stealthily the dark haunts round, and when a lamp goes, without sound, at a swifter bound than the swiftest hound, arrives, and all else is drowned. And I and star and wind and deer are in the dark together, near, yet far, and fear drums in my ear at that sage company drear. How weak and little is the light, all the universe of sight, love and delight, before the might, if you love it not, of night.
And let's conclude with another ancient hymn, dating from the 3rd or 4th century, but which is still recited in the evening office of the Greek church. St. Basil wrote of it,
"Our fathers did not wish to receive the grace of the evening light in silence. As soon as it appeared, they blessed God. We do not know the name of the author of this hymn of thanksgiving, an ancient canticle which all the people continue to recite. O Christ Jesus, radiant light of the immortal glory of the Father of heaven, as the sun sinks to its setting, we are face to face with the twilight of evening. We honour God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. You are worthy ever to be hymned by voices that are pure. Son of God, who gives us life, the universe proclaims your glory."
And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. And we saw his glory, the glory, as it were, of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth.
You were listening there to this week's edition of There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, presented by Jill Bevilacqua. She'll be back again at this same time next week. Meanwhile, time to join Dominican preacher and poet Father Paul Murray for The Task of Happiness, Human Suffering and Christian Joy. In this programme, which is part 5 of a series, Father Murray speaks to us of what he refers to as the third road to joy. Let's listen.
The third road to joy is by far the most unexpected of all, the path that is most paradoxical. For here, joy is attained by what is apparently its very opposite, namely, by the experience of suffering. But how, since it is so often destructive of human happiness, can suffering bring joy? In the Gospel, Jesus links these two words, these two realities together, in an astonishing way. Happy or blessed are you, he says, when people hate you and when they exclude and insult you. Rejoice and leap for joy on that day. The first thing to note here is the central place given to happiness in Jesus' teaching. Of all the doctors of the church, St. Thomas Aquinas was perhaps the most aware of this fact. Thomas notes, for example, that in the Sermon on the Mount and in the Beatitudes, Jesus draws our attention not only to the various precepts of the law, but also to the fact, the wondrous, saving fact, that our lives in this world and in the next are ordered towards happiness. The Beatitudes represent, in fact, nothing less than God's answer to our human search for happiness. And the Beatitudes are addressed, all of them, to people who have taken the risk of loving others or of loving God. For immediately we decide to love someone, not just to fall in love, but to stand in love, we at once become vulnerable in all kinds of ways, and not least to the pain of loss that we will experience if that person abandons us, for example, or if he or she dies. Blessed are they who mourn, for they shall be comforted. I have entitled this third road to joy, The Experience of Suffering, but it could perhaps more accurately be called The Experience of Loving. For real love, although it gives us a sense of happiness like nothing else in the world, also brings with it a new mysterious sorrow. We become aware, and with a vividness not perhaps experienced elsewhere, of something of our own and the other person's most pressing need and vulnerability. And here, as in all our close relationships, it is necessary, as Mother Teresa says, to love until it hurts.
Yes, there is not only hunger for bread, there is hunger for love. And he loved us so much that he died on the cross. And we too must love until it hurts.
Love demands two things, surrender and self-sacrifice. This truth is something that the world, the materialistic world at any rate, never seems to understand. But it is something that every lover knows by instinct. Nobody understands lovers except themselves. Nobody understands their willingness to completely forget themselves, throwing to the winds their own selfish interests. And nobody understands their joy. In the context of the Christian life, it is only the man or the woman who has abandoned self and completely gone forth from self, as Meister Eckhart puts it, for whom nothing could be a cross or pain or suffering. It would all be a joy. The self-sacrifice involved in going out from oneself does not always come easy, even to the lover. There may be a certain impulse or instinct towards self-sacrifice, and that is wonderful. But instinct is not enough. The journey towards a great relationship presupposes a profound gift of grace, that, first of all, but also a lot of hard work. One vivid illustration of this journey from self-centeredness to self-forgetfulness comes from the ancient Persian tradition. It is the story of a rather egotistical young man who falls in love with a beautiful woman. They get to know one another, and one day he decides to ask her to marry him. He goes to her door and knocks.
"Who is it?" a voice replies. "It's me," he says confidently. But the voice within says, "I'm sorry, I don't know you." The young man is deeply upset at these words and goes away puzzled. The next day he returns, knocks on the door again, still feeling pretty confident. "Who is it?" the voice answers. "It's me," he shouts this time, emphasizing the me. "I'm sorry, I don't know you." This reply completely bewilders the young man. He goes away and stays away for weeks. In fact, he goes alone out into a desert, where night and day he fasts and prays. Then he returns to the door of the woman he loves. He knocks on the door. The voice from within replies, "Who is it?" This time, pressing his face up very close to the door, he whispers quietly, "It's you." And the door opens.
What the young man discovered through his own experience of suffering is that the door of life, the door of joy, never opens if it is approached merely in a selfish spirit. Like every man, like every human being, he is naturally drawn to seek pleasure and to possess the thing that he desires. But what he discovered in the desert is that the hidden desire, the deepest desire in his heart, is not to seize joy for himself, but rather to give joy and to give pleasure to the one he loves. And so the journey he has made is, we can say, a journey from a place of selfishness, it's me, to a place of self-forgetfulness and communion, it's you.
You were listening there to a Dominican preacher and poet, Father Paul Murray. In part five of the series, The Task of Happiness, Human Suffering and Christian Joy. That brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, wishing you all a very happy and peaceful New Year once again. Should you wish to find out more about our programming, check out our website. The address is www.radiovaticana.va, and be sure to like our Facebook page. You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.